17 of Nehemiah. The chapter is entitled Descent of the River Ganges. There's two verses, text 8 and text 9, because text 8 has no purport. Series goes back to text 5. So I'll read text. Just read the translations, because these are all prose verses. And I'll preface the first part by saying one of Prabhupada's disciples named Sadaputta Prabhu was, he's now deceased. When he was younger, he was a PhD graduate from State University in New York, and his field, his PhD was in mathematics, but he was a brilliant person. I would say in my lifetime the closest thing to someone that I've met that I would say is a genius is Sadaputta. So when he was younger, around the time that Prabhupada was speaking about, so it was 1974 or 75, he was speaking about building a temple of Vedic planetarium. You've heard that before? Temple of Vedic planetarium. That's not a usual name that you call a temple. You know, Radha Gopinath temple, or Radha Govinda Mandir, or Radha Madhava temple, something like that. Temple of Vedic Planetarium, very unusual. Because what Prabhupada wanted, although the deities were Radha Madhava and Panchatattva, now also both, he wanted to do several things. He wanted to display the wisdom of the Srimad Bhagavatam, where you could see it. Specifically, there are two areas of the knowledge of the Vedas, or the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, that a scientist can empirically study. One of them is the structure of the universe, down to how many miles in diameter are different planets, the distance between this planet and that planet and another planet, and so on. The cosmology of the universe with numbers and names. So scientists can study that. The language of the Bhagavatam makes it not so accessible, a little mysterious, but it's there. So what Prabhupada, and another area was anthropology, or the history of mankind, the development of the genealogy of different kings and manus and periods of time and cycles of time of different manus in the days of Brahma and so on. So those are things that, you know, at least archaeology can try to experiment with. So those are empirical areas that the Bhagavatam and modern science both address. So Prabhupada wanted a temple of Vedic planetarium which would depict one of those two, and that scholarly people from all over the world would come and check it out. And when they came to check it out, they would get Lord Chaitanya's mercy, because it's going to be in Mayapur. So they go see the temple of Vedic planetarium, and then over there is Radha Madhava, and over there is Lord Nrisingadeva, and all around is the places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. That was Prabhupada's plan, bringing Western people, or people from all over the world, not just Western, people outside of India, to the holy Dham of Lord Chaitanya, to get Lord Chaitanya's mercy, and to increase their faith in the Vedic wisdom. It's phenomenal. even in empiric areas, but to speak of areas that we can't measure. So he gave the service to Sariputta Prabhu specifically, because he's a genius, to study the fifth canto and make a plan of how to depict the cosmology of the universe for the temple of Vedic Planetarium. Imagine having that as a job assignment. That's up there. So for years and years and years, he studied. He did other things, but he was, it's all revolving around this primary instruction, because Prabhupada is very serious. He wanted it to be built. And you have to have something inside it that says it's the Vedic Planetarium. So one of the things that he did was he studied the cosmology of different cultures around the world. When I say cosmology, what does that mean? It means a picture of the cosmos. It's the how people of different cultures view what's up there, the sky above, and all the planets, and what's the universe look like inside it. Cosmology. And from cosmology comes astrology. Knowing, just not to go into too much detail, but if you know the time of someone's birth down to the minute, and you know the latitude and longitude, then you can say at that particular time all the cosmology construction was such and such. And then you can cast an astrological chart knowing cosmology. So cosmology is the root of astrology. But it was for practical things, not just, you know, doing somebody's chart. It was when to plant your crops, because they would know various things about, you know, when is auspicious and inauspicious time, when will there be lots of rain, when will there be not enough rain. When to begin an undertaking, some journey or something, a business, or people's lives when they were qualified brahmanas had guidance from their knowledge of cosmology. It was important in day-to-day life. Not everybody knew that science, but certain qualified brahmanas were very skilled, and they could predict. You know, they could, based on astrological influence, they could say what would happen, or at least the influences that are playing upon circumstances of life. So he studied the cosmologies of the world, and what I'm about to read, he writes in his book, Vedic Cosmology and Astronomy or something like that. There's a whole chapter that studies different cultures, and what you're going to hear is almost identical with the cosmology of hundreds of other cultures. The names are different, but the principles are the same. And he found that there are scholars who have studied this before him, and you know, when you have a cosmology that's similar in Siberia, in Africa, in Afghanistan, in Canada and South America, and in Australasia, and Europe, and you know, just keep naming the places, and there's such almost identical symmetry between cosmologies. The scholars came up with three possibilities. One possibility was it's genetically coded within mankind that they have to come up with cosmology that's alike all around the world. And then he kind of ruled that one out. It's not so likely that it's genetically determined that everyone has to have the same cosmology. Then the second possibility was it's chance. It just happened that way. And that's not so plausible either. So the third alternative that they looked at was, once upon a time, there was a culture throughout the world And because there was one culture throughout the world, there was one cosmology. And as cultures diversified over time, that one cosmology became slightly different this way, slightly different that way. And they said, although that's the most plausible, we don't like it. Because, you know, we don't like the idea that once upon a time there was one culture all over the world, but we like it. Because there was one culture all over the world. Vedic culture. I'll tell one little experience. In my service to the GBC, I visited China once. And the capital of China is Beijing. So when I was visiting Beijing, there was morning program, evening program, and during the day the devotees wanted to know if I wanted to go sightseeing. I said, no, I don't want to go sightseeing. I'll come. We're going to take you to see Beijing. Please come. So they were so insistent, I understood it would be culturally not nice if I didn't go, so I went. And there were two places that they were considering taking me to. One was where the palace of the previous, one of the dynasties of kings, it's called the Forbidden Palace. So we didn't go there. The Ming Dynasty. Huge thing. And then, but directly across the street is the Temple of Heaven. Temple of Heaven. So that's where we went. And it wasn't just one building. It was bigger than Central Park. It was this huge place. And Central Park was busy, but there were a gazillion people there. I mean, like, it was like New York City at rush hour in the subway system. And it was all over. There's so many people in China. Obviously, it's one quarter of the world's population in that little space. Huge population. So there were people all over the place. And I'll make the description shorter, but the temple of the first, there were three parts, and the first part was there were three. You go up a hill, and then there's like a plateau, a flat area at the top, and then the main attraction is the Temple of Heaven. And you have a long line to go up and see it, just like look inside, darshan of the Temple of Heaven. And there's an altar to the King of Heaven, Indra. It didn't say Indra. And then in a V shape, kind of coming out towards you, there were the temple of the sun, the temple of the moon, the temple of the wind, the temple of this. It was demigod worship. And it had altars in front of each of those. You know, this is during the Ming Dynasty, and over there is the picture of this Ming and that Ming and the other kings of the Ming Dynasty that set all this up. It was Vedic culture in China. But, you know, there's some archaeological evidence. It's not like it's just in the Bhagavatam that says Kashadesh. That's what they call the Chinese yatra. Because in the Bhagavatam, it's Kasha. It's a tract of land known as Kasha or Kashadesh, and there was Vedic culture there. And then there's a third building where it's the Upadevatas. Then you go to another area and it's cosmology. It's Vedic cosmology. But they just have different names. But it's Vedic culture, and you know they're honoring the denizens of the heavenly region. And the Ming Dynasty was like, you know, they were big supporters of this. So, point again, all over the world, this was very well developed because it was a very well developed culture. But all over the world, the picture that I'm about to read to you was presented. He shows, Sariputta in his book shows pictures where there's a mountain and there's a river coming down, vertically down, and then there's four rivers coming from that one river that then hits the mountain and goes in four directions. Common, like it's like a logo or brand to show the cosmology picture. So this is the descent of the Ganges, that's that river, and it hits Mount Meru and it goes in four directions. So listen to the Bhagavatam's depiction of the descent of the river Ganges. Text number 5. On top of Mount Meru, the Ganges divides into four branches, each of which gushes in a different direction, east, west, north, and south. These branches, known by the name Sita, Alakananda, Chakshu, and Bhadra, flow down to the ocean. Text 6. The branch of the Ganges known as the Sita flows through Brahmapuri atop Mount Meru, and from there it runs down to the nearby peaks of the Kesarachala Mountains, which stand almost as high as Mount Meru itself. These mountains are like a bunch of filaments around Mount Meru. From the Kesarachala Mountains, the Ganges then falls to the peaks known as Gandhamadana Mountain, and then flows into the land of Bhadrashrava Varsha. Finally, it reaches the ocean of salt water in the west. Text 7. The branch of the Ganges known as Chakshu falls onto the summit of the Malyavan Mountains, and from there cascades onto the land of Ketumala Varsha. The Ganges flows incessantly through Ketumala Varsha, and in this way also reaches the ocean of salt water in the west. The branch of the Ganges known as Bhadra flows from the northern side of Mount Meru. Its waters fall onto the peaks of Kumuda Mountain, Mount Nila, Shveta Mountain, and Shringavan Mountain in succession. Then it runs down into the province of Kuru, and after crossing through that land, flows into the salt water ocean in the north. And then the last of the four, you'll recognize it says Bharat Varsha. That's where we are. Similarly, the branch of the Ganges named Alakananda flows from the southern side of Brahmapuri, passing over the tops of mountains in various lands. It falls down with force upon the peaks of the mountains Hemakuta and Himakuta. After inundating the tops of these mountains, the Ganges falls onto the tract of land known as Bharata Varsha, which she, that's Ganga, also inundates. Then the Ganges flows into the ocean of salt water in the south. Persons who come to bathe in this river are fortunate. It is not very difficult for them to achieve, with every step, the results of performing great sacrifices like the Rajasuya and Ashwamedha Yajna. how this happens isn't explained. It just explains what it does. But I'll share one little perspective on this. Two things. Some persons I know have gone to the what's called the mouth of the Ganges, the Gangotri. And at the Gangotri, water is just pouring out of a mountain. It's not melted ice or snow, it's just pouring out of a mountain. Where does it come from? It's the descent of the Ganges. It's a little mystical, but here's another one. In the course of our travels during the South Indian Yatra, took a group of devotees just in the month of January to the places where Lord Chaitanya traveled during his pilgrimage in South India. South India tour, it's called the chapter. So one of the places that we went is Simhachalam. You heard of Simhachalam before? Simha. Lord Nrisimhadev deity there. And Achala means hill. Simha. Achala. So it's on top of, you go up, 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 way up, and there's a temple. And it's a temple of Varaha Nrisimha. So it's so up and so remote that the question is, somebody might ask, how do they get their supplies? Because they're so far up. And there's two answers. One is that the food supply naturally is there because there's so many different trees, and in different seasons they produce everything that the deity needs and the devotee serving the deity needs. All their necessities are supplied just by nature. Now they bring in rice and stuff like that because it's part of the culture. But it's not, they don't have rice paddies up in the mountain like you have here. They bring the rice up, but there are other natural edibles that abundantly, they're just naturally supplied. And their water supply, in one of the peaks of the mountains, there's a, same thing as Gangotri, there's a gushing stream that's flowing all the time. And so the pujaris, very early in the morning, there's a certain group that do this, they go and get water that's used all day for the deity. They don't have a well, they just go gather the water that's flowing from the mountain. And where does that water come from? It's just flowing. If there's no snowfall, it's that melting snow or ice, it's just coming out of the mountain. And this is in Andhra Pradesh, and there was a period of time where for several years, maybe you recall reading this from Lilamrita, for like 5 or 6 years there was a drought in Andhra Pradesh. There was no rain. But the devotees there in Simhachalam didn't have a problem because they had constant water supply just coming out of the mountain. So, not rainfall, not snow, not ice, just coming out of the mountain. Where did it come from? They say it's one of the tributaries of the Ganges, just like descending. And it flows down the river, or flows down the mountain. Mystical. So, the verses don't describe how flowing from this place to that place. And it apparently is from heavenly realms down to middle range realms to earthly realms and even lower realms, because there's a description in the Ganga, excuse me, description in the Bhagavatam, where the Kumaras and various sages from Brahmaloka, yes, this is in the third canto, Kumaras and sages from Brahmaloka wanted to hear Srimad Bhagavatam from Lord Sankarshan. And where is Lord Sankarshan in the cosmology of the universe? He's at the bottom, because the universe, the planets of the universe are resting on his foot, so he's at the bottom. So they entered into the Ganges in Brahmaloka, and by their mystic art, they traveled through the Ganges to the bottom of the universe, and they began asking questions of Lord Sankarshan. And he responded by giving the answers as Srimad Bhagavatam. This is what I just spoke as narrated by Maitreya Muni to Vidura, because Vidura is asking a whole bunch of questions. And Maitreya says, wow, your questions are really good. They're just like the questions that the Kumaras asked Lord Sankarshan when they did this thing. So the Ganges goes all the way from the topmost part of the universe to the bottommost part of the universe. Now, do we see it like flying through space? I mean, how does it happen? It doesn't give the technology how it happens. It just says it floats. And so it does. Like, you know, water just coming out of a mountain. And it's not even like it's like there's a big pump at the bottom of the mountain. It's forcing water coming out. Like we have these holding tanks. And once the holding tank is filled, then the force of the water going down, because water flows down, you can get water coming out of the tap. But to get it into the tank, you have to pump it up into the tank. So there's not a pump somewhere down there, and it's like sending this water up to the top of the mountain, it's flowing down the mountain. It's just flowing down the mountain from some higher region. Doesn't give the technology. Beyond our ability to measure. But it happens. We didn't go and physically examine the water coming out of the mountain. But one devotee said the brahmanas, local brahmins who had the responsibility to gather the water, once took a group of our ISKCON devotees there, and they showed them, there's the water that we get for centuries. We don't have any want or need. Krishna's taking care of us. Very nice. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The place where the Ganges flows into the salt water at the Bay of Bengal is still known as Ganga Sagara, or the meeting place of the Ganges and the Bay of Bengal. On Makara Sankranti, what's Makara Sankranti? We have it in our Vaishnava calendars, January 14th. On the solar calendar, Makara Sankranti. It's the same every year because it's a solar date. It's a date when the sun is moving on. It's called an ecliptic. Those of you that have eighth grade science, you learned this. As the Earth is moving around the sun. And that happens in 24 hours. The sun is moving. The Earth is moving. So there's day and night within 24 hours. But as the Earth is moving, simultaneously also the sun is moving. The sun is not just fixed, stationary. The sun is also moving. And in relation to the earth, they're not only day and night, but there's also seasons. And for those of us that are in the northern hemisphere, the seasons are when the sun is in the northernmost position, that's summer solstice, where the days are longest and the nights are shortest. That's when the sun is in the northernmost position. And then it's moving down, 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 where it crosses the equator, and it's called equinox, where days and nights are equal. And then down, 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 when it hits the southernmost position, where the nights are longest and the days are shortest, because it's in the southern hemisphere. For those in the northern hemisphere, that's the winter solstice, and that's Makara Sankranti, when the sun starts moving in the northern direction again, up, 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 up. Days and nights are equal. Keeps going up, 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 and the days are longest and nights are shortest. The movement of the sun like that is called ecliptic. And it keeps doing it once a year. Summer and winter seasons end when the days and nights are equal in between. It's Makara Sankranti is when Bhishma Dev left his body. Remember that from the Mahabharata or the first canto of Bhagavatam? He would only have to give up his body when he wanted to give up his body. So he's right in the middle of this wonderful discourse with the Pandavas while he's on his bed of arrows, and Makara Sankranti comes. So Bhishma Dev says, okay, I'm going to leave my body now, because the sun in its northerly direction, from Bhagavad Gita we know, when the soul leaves the body, when the sun is moving in the northerly direction, then the soul goes to the spiritual world. I mean, there's other conditions that are evolved also. But Bhishma Dev met those. And Bhishma Dev doesn't need to pick an auspicious time. But he did, because he's Bhishma Dev. So that's Makara Sankranti. And in India, Makara Sankranti is a big festival. Big festival. They call it something else in South India. Now, in the Caribbean here, do you have another name for Makara Sankranti? A festival? No? Don't observe it. When we were in South India, it was right around that time, Makara Sankranti is when we finished our tour on the 15th. But the 14th, it's part of a 10-day festival. We were in Sridharangam, and it's a huge festival, huge festival. It's like our Janmashtami. Huge festival. 10-day festival. It's all the deity of Ranganath. The Utsav Murti comes out of the temple, and on different palanquins is taken throughout different neighborhoods throughout Sri Lanka. One day on the Hamsa Vimana of Lord Brahma, another day the Nandi of Lord Shiva, and so on. It's very elaborate with the whole story behind it, which I'm not going to narrate right now. So on Makara Sankranti, another tradition is that devotees who want to take bath in the Ganga, it's especially auspicious to take bath in the Ganga on Makara Sankranti. And it's especially auspicious where the Ganga meets the Bay of Bengal. So that's called Ganga Sagara. The confluence of the Ganges enters the Bay of Bengal. I'll tell some stories connected to that in just a moment. On Makara Sankranti, in the month of January, February, thousands of people still go to bathe there, Ganga Sagar, hoping to be liberated. That they can actually be liberated in this way is confirmed in this verse. For those who bathe in the Ganges at any time, the result of great sacrifices, like the Ashwamedha and Rajasuya Yajnas, are not at all difficult to achieve. Most people in India
are still inclined to bathe in the Ganges, and there are many places where they can do so. At Prayag, Allahabad, many thousands of people gather during the month of January to bathe in the confluence of the Ganges and the Jamuna. Magh Mela, you've heard that. But every year. There's Kumbh Mela, that's not every year, but Magh Mela is every year. So the Ganges and the Jamuna meet at that place, at Prayag. So Prayag Tirtha is one of the primary tirthas in all of India. And especially in the month of Magh, they go to bathe there. Afterward, many of them go to the confluence of the Bay of Bengal and the Ganges to take bath there. Thus, it is a special facility for all people of India that they can bathe in the water of the Ganges at so many places of pilgrimage. So if you take birth in India, you have this easier access. We can still go from Guyana or America or Europe or wherever. But when you're in India, it's so much easier. So many pilgrimage places along the path of the Ganges and going there on special occasions with a special benediction. So one of those special benedictions is this Ganga Sagara. I'm going to narrate two stories that illustrate this. One of them is, they're both related to a place in Puri that's called Sweta Ganga. Sweta Ganga is a sarovar or a tank or a kund, a bathing place that is said to be non-different than the Ganges. So some people say, yeah, right, not different than the Ganges. Don't take it seriously. But some do. And one of those persons that took it seriously was a Brahmana who was born into a Brahmana family, and he had some service of Lord Jagannath in Jagannath Puri. So one day, after finishing his morning duties worshipping the deity at the temple of Jagannath, he went to Sweta Ganga to take his bath. And as he was taking his bath, he was thinking, wouldn't it be very nice to go to Ganga Sagara and be able to take bath in the Ganga at the confluence where the river Ganga flows into the Bay of Bengal. So when he immersed himself into the water up to his head, and he then rose out of the water, he found himself at Ganga Sagara. And he was amazed, because, you know, it wasn't all the same exterior, but he could recognize where he was. And not only that, there was a woman who approached him and said, "You're supposed to be my husband." And then she explained that she had been worshipping Lord Jagannath, and Lord Jagannath appeared to her in a dream that night before and said, "I am going to bring one man to become your husband. He will go to such and such place at Ganga Sagara, and in the morning when he appears out of the river, you will know that this is your husband." So he didn't know what to say. This is a little surprising, and here I am, instead of in Puri, I'm in Ganga Sagara. And not only that, here you are approaching me saying that, you know, Lord Jagannath told you that I'm supposed to become your husband. It appears that Jagannath brought me here, and it appears that this is something that Jagannath wants, that we become married. And so they married. And the very next morning, when he went to the bank of the river Jamuna, to perform his morning duties, and immersed himself in, up to his head in the Ganga. When he came out of the water, he was at Sweta Ganga again. So he was amazed. Like, what's going on? So he didn't say anything to anybody, because there's a rule in Puri that if you're a pujari in Puri, you must marry a Brahmani girl from Puri, and if you don't, you lose your status as a pujari. So he didn't tell anybody anything. And some years passed, and he was finishing his duties, worshipping Jagannath, and was leaving the temple, and as he was leaving the temple, a woman approached him and said, "My dear husband, I'm so happy to see you here in Puri. And who are you? Don't you remember? Maybe because it was, we were only together for one night, but I'm your wife." "Oh." "And yes, and here's your son. We were together on our wedding night. Here's, we had union, and here's your son." "No." So as they were speaking, it was overheard by other pujaris, and they were saying, "What's going on? What's going on?" You know how it goes. "Hey, what's going on? What's going on?" So it became a big hubbub, and after some days it was such a disturbance that it was brought to the chief priest. And the chief priest said to the woman, "How do we know what you're saying is true?" And she said, "Here's, when we were married, I brought with me the ring and the ornaments and the cloth that my husband gave me. And here they are, you can see. They're heirlooms from his family." And the man blushed and said, "Those are my ornaments. It's true." So then, but you know, I didn't want to say anything because I would lose my position. Then the chief priest said, "This all happened by the plan of Lord Jagannath. So although this is an exception, it's Jagannath's will, so you can continue in your service." And then the wife said, "But what about my son? What's his service? Because the way that you get service in Puri is you take birth in a family, and then because you're in that family, you get that service. It's hereditary. It's not our system. It's not the Panchatantrika system. It's a different system, the Vedic system." So the chief priest said, "Well, we have some 28 different services that are done, but this is such a unique service. Situation, we'll have to create another service." So he created another service. And that person's descendants are still to this day engaged in whatever that 29th service is. So this is where the statement with the Ganga and it's this descent through the universe is non-different throughout the different places where the Ganga travels. And there's another very amazing description where it's written up in the back of the Godhead magazine. Maybe some of you have heard the name Ganga Mata Goswamini. Any of you heard that name before? There are several women in our disciplic succession who became initiating spiritual masters. Janava, the wife of Nityananda, she's one. And Hemalata, the daughter of Srinivas Acharya, she's another. And Ganga Mata Goswamini is another. They were extremely qualified, as you'll hear. So Ganga Mata Goswamini in her childhood She was born in what is now Bangladesh, then it was West Bengal, to the daughter of a king. And the king had no sons, he had only one daughter, and her name was Sita. So the system was, and is, but the system was that if there's no son, then there's like all these different what happens if you don't have a son. So the daughter would become queen, and the man that she would marry would become king. So when it became time for Sita to be married, from childhood she had exceptionally incredible devotion to Krishna. So she told her father, I'm not going to marry any man that's been born. I only will marry the immortal Krishna as my husband. So the father thought, my daughter's being a little unrealistic here, a little stubborn. Maybe in course of time she'll change. She didn't change. She was her mood of devotion was Krishna is my husband. So she never got married. And the father passed away and the mother passed away and she became the queen without a king. Queen Sita. And she was very competent. She ruled the kingdom very, very effectively. But her heart was given to Krishna. So she wanted to go visit various places of pilgrimage. Her real desire was she wanted to find a spiritual master. So she set up things so that she could take a leave of absence, you know, a little tour, and she went to Puri. And when she went to Puri, she found vestiges of Lord Chaitanya's presence there, but the bhakti had not sustained in the same way, and she was told it has been sustained very nicely in Vrindavan. So she went to Vrindavan. Queen, going to Vrindavan to find the spiritual master. And she heard from many different personalities. But the one that inspired her the most was Haridas. Haridas Pandit, I believe. Haridas Pandit. Gadadhar Pandit had a disciple named Ananta. And Ananta had a disciple named Haridas Pandit. So Haridas Pandit, having heard the Bhagavatam from his spiritual master, heard it directly from Gadadhar Pandit, he was very, very elevated Vaishnava. He's the same Haridas Pandit that's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where he's one of the principal ones to instruct Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami to write Chaitanya Charitamrita. So that gives you an idea of the time sequence historically, just after Lord Chaitanya, just a couple generations. So having heard from Haridas Pandit, she became very inspired, and after some time she approached him and requested him for initiation. He said, no, you're a queen, you can't become my disciple. I only live here in Vrindavan, and here in Vrindavan everything is very austere. You're used to royal opulence, and how could you live in Vrindavan and remain here? No, I can't accept you as a disciple. She didn't become discouraged. She understood this is Haridas Pandit examining me. He's testing my determination, my sincerity. So she gave up her royal ornaments and royal robes and all of her regal paraphernalia, and she adopted the life of a mendicant. She wore one cloth, had one cloth only, and that's all she wore, and she slept by the side of the Jamuna River, a queen.
And it's dangerous to sleep by the woman sleeping by the side of the river Jamuna. But with the other lady mendicant, she just lived that life, and her sustenance was madhukari. Madhukari is just, you go door to door and whatever people give, and that's it. She's a queen doing madhukari in Vrindavan. She did that for a year and continued every day and came to hear Haridas Pandit. Then again, after 1 year, she approached him. And by this time, she's lean, thin, and a little, all of her regal appearance is now covered. So he was amazed at the degree of determination and capacity for austerity, and he agreed to accept her as a disciple. So she continued to hear and study the Bhagavatam from him. And after some time, another one of his disciples, whose name I can't remember, forget the other disciple's name, came, and she was chanting 3 lakhs of names a day, like Haridas Thakur, 64 times 3 rounds a day. And he told them, you both go live in Radhakund. Then Radhakund wasn't what it is today. It was very, very simple. Raghunath Das had just excavated the two places, Radhakund, Shamakund, and they made their residence in between Radhakund, Shamakund. And today, if you go to Radhakund, you can find the temple of Gangamata Goswamini. That's where the two of them resided. And they heard regularly from Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami and the elevated Vaishnavas who were residing there at that time. So they became very, very fixed in scripture. Every day they did Govardhan Parikrama. Every day they did service to Radhakund. Every day they heard Srimad Bhagavatam from these great, great, great spiritual personalities. Then one day, Haridas Pandit gave Sita Devi an instruction. He said, I received word that there's nobody worshipping the deity of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. So I want you to go and worship Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's deity in Puri. This is my instruction for you. And his main deity was a Damodar Shiva. And those of you that know these things, women are not supposed to worship, by Smarta Brahmins, they're not supposed to worship Shalagram. But on the order of Haridas, she did. She violated what, and in Puri, Smarta rules are like big deal. Right? I mean, they won't let Westerners go into the temple, for example. And when we went there, there were some devotees from India that could speak 5 different languages, Gujarati and Bengali and Hindi and different languages, and they wouldn't let them in because their complexion was fair rather than a darker complexion. They just they went through hours of ordeal and they wouldn't let them in. They tried to sneak in. They got their sticks. They were going to beat them. You can't enter. So Smarta rules are a big deal in Puri. Here comes a woman, Sita Devi, worshipping Damodar Shila, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Some people were like, hey, what's going on? You can't do this. But it was the order of her spiritual master, and she was fearless, and she was very determined. And after some time, as she began a morning Bhagavatam class, just as she had been for years been trained to hear, this was also part of her instruction, speak the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. And she spoke so beautifully that very quickly news spread, wow, this really qualified Sita Devi is speaking so nicely. And even the king heard. And when the king heard her speak Srimad Bhagavatam, he thought, I want to do something for her. She's so qualified. So in a dream, Lord Jagannath instructed her that
you should give her some land and let her establish a little ashram for herself and her followers. So the king gave him the regal land, the property of the king, very near to where the house of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is, but it's a little bit away. And both of those places are near Sweta Ganga. So Ganga Sagara, Makara Sankranti was coming, and she, Sita Devi, very much wanted to go to Ganga Sagara and take bath in the, just like the verse is describing, during Makara Sankranti. But she, and many, many people were going from Puri, but she couldn't go because she had the order of her spiritual master to stay there for the rest of her life and worship Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's deity. So she stayed. But in the evening, she had a dream, and the dream said, "Don't worry, I'll make an arrangement for you. You can go to Ganga Sagara and take bath." But because the Sweta Ganga, this kund, this tank very near to where you are, it's none different than the Ganga. And at night, you can go there very late, and no one will disturb you, and you can take your bath in the Ganga that way. Just some short distance from your ashram. So she went late at night, and as she entered into the Ganga, the Sweta Ganga, the water started rising. It's a big tank, like, you know, big. And this rose very, very quickly. In fact, it flowed out of the walls surrounding the tank and carried her directly into the temple of Lord Jagannath, which is quite a distance away. And when the gush of water subsided, there she was in the middle of the temple floor. And the doors are locked. So the guards heard this noise inside the temple, and they opened unlocked the doors and went inside and found this mendicant woman. And they thought, "She's a thief. She's come here in the middle of the night to steal from Lord Jagannath." And they grabbed her and put her in the king's prison. This is in the dead of night. That night, the king had a dream. Lord Jagannath chastised him severely. "Your men have arrested Sita Devi. I personally brought her here by my own plan so I could get her association, because she's so busy serving the Shalagram Shila of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. I never get her association. She's so pure in her devotion. And now you put her in jail. You've made a big offense. You immediately go and release her from prison, fall at her feet, and beg to take initiation from her." The king. So the king woke up and went to the prison, and sure enough, she was in prison. That very night, he released her from prison, fell at her feet, and begged for her initiation. She just laughed. He said, "Lord Jagannath has such a sense of humor." From that day, her name was no longer Sita Devi, but people knew her as Ganga Mata Goswamini. On an auspicious day, she initiated the king. And after some time, many others became her disciple, including big, well-known at the time pundits who were thinking, "Who is this woman that everyone's raving about? Who is this person?" So they went, and when they had her association, they were similarly moved. They wanted her to accept them as disciples, and they became her disciples. So Ganga Sagara is a very special place, where persons that may not know about the Brahmana priest of Jagannath or Ganga Mata Goswamini, they go there just because they've heard from scripture that this is a very sacred time and a sacred place, and they want to go there. And according to this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, one who goes there can easily become liberated and easily receive the benefit of so many Rajasuya and Ashvamedha yajnas. Now, the Bhagavatam conclusion. The Bhagavatam also glorifies, even above bathing in the river Ganges, the chanting of the holy name. And how easily accessible. We don't have to go to Ganga Sagara. We just chant the holy name. And it's millions of times, it's incomparable, the benefit of chanting the holy name compared to this. But we take it for granted because it's so easy. If it was not so easy, we wouldn't even try for it, or few people would try for it. So in this age of Kali, it's made easily accessible. Just like, you know, when we came in from the boat, this isn't the first time, I was ready for it this time. As soon as we landed with the boat, the taxi drivers wanted to take us, you know, get all of us and get the money. It's all highball. You know, in the same way, coming down. It's, everybody knows us. In America, people know us as the Hare Krishnas. And here, it's, people know us as the Hare Balls. But they're chanting Krishna's name. You know, they want to make some money. That's why they're chanting Krishna's name. But it's, you know, it's all over. And when on my checking in to the airport at JFK to come down, one of the persons at the this happened last time too. One of the persons at the security check, they check your luggage to see if you have any bad things in it. You know, the man folded palms, you know, Hare Krishna, I went to your temple for Gaur Purnima. You know, from the fruit of the work of the devotees to extend Krishna consciousness to others, people come to know about the Hare Krishna movement, and because they know the Hare Krishna movement or the Hare Bol movement, you know, they're saying Krishna's name, and they're getting same benefits as being described in this verse of bathing in the Ganges at Ganga Sagara at Makara Sankranti, just from chanting Krishna's name. It's such mercy. And we're so close to it that we don't necessarily appreciate it sufficiently. But it's a very, very powerful and very merciful means to take us out of the darkness of Kali Yuga and into the light of Krishna consciousness, along with the wonderful instructions found in Srimad Bhagavatam. Hare Krishna. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.